You're listening to Leadership Powered by Common Sense with your host, Doug Thorpe. Here's Doug.
Hello, everyone. This is Leadership Powered by Common Sense. We're back, and I'm Doug Thorpe. And today we're going to be talking about the ownership journey. If you've ever had a business, started a business, you know it is a journey. There's no simple pattern one way or the other that anybody experiences. And if you're thinking about jumping out there and starting your own business, you might well want to listen in and get some tips and ideas. Learn from those that have done it before and give you some great running start at it. My guest is a gentleman named Bruce Werner. Bruce, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so Bruce and I were just chatting a bit. While we were in the green room, at the time of this recording, I in the Houston area, we're celebrating the Astros' victory in the World Series. So it's fresh off the press, and Bruce was talking about the baseball world up in Chicago, which has had their moments, and they did okay, but generally, I guess it's a struggle sometimes. But
it's very polite.
Anyway, all of us are long-suffering fans, one way or another. So hey, the Bears are doing better this year, right?
Yep. The other, I joke with my friends, people love sports in Chicago because there's not much else to do. There's no mountains or national parks or beaches or, things to get away to. So you go to the ballpark.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Well, enough of that. Let's get into the ownership journey. So Bruce, before we do get there, why don't you tell us a little bit about your own journey and things you've done in your career to get to where you are right now?
Sure. So I spent the first half of my career at our family business. I'm third generation of the Werner family. We own Werner Ladder. Hopefully, if you have a ladder out in your garage, it has our name on it. In addition to the climbing products business, we also own the largest independent aluminum extruder in the country. So Ford, GM, and Chrysler were my tier one accounts. We also had a property and casualty insurance company. So like a lot of kids in family business, all I want to do was grow up to be president of the Werner Company. So I spent the first half of my career there. We had a pretty good run, but our markets changed in the late 90s. And so as a family, the business is an asset to protect the family. It's not a child. So we made the right decision at the right time for the right reason and sold the business in 97. I left in 2000. Since then, I've started four different businesses, was a partner in a private equity fund. In the last about 10 years or so, split my time between consulting to private and family businesses and serving as an independent director for those same businesses. Most of my consulting clients are 10 to 100 million revenue, and my board work is typically 100 to 500 million revenue businesses.
And are any of those international, or are they all domestic?
They happen to be domestic because that's where my relationships are. But, as I always say, if a plane can get me there, I'm happy to do the work.
Yeah. Well, I asked that question because it's not uncommon for even smaller businesses to have opportunity to go global. And
absolutely.
I always like to keep that on the table because especially for those that are entertaining the idea of getting into a business, it's not as prohibitive as it once was.
Absolutely true. So, for companies under 10 million revenue, your supply chain is predominantly Asian, if not exclusively. So everyone kind of knows how to work with that. And depending upon your kind of how you go to market and who you're targeting, through e-commerce, you can ship anywhere. So it really takes the whole marketing question of who are my customers? Where do I have a competitive advantage? Where do I have the capital to compete? And where I can go make some hay? And if it's overseas, that's great. It's not like it used to be where you wouldn't think about going more than 500 miles.
Right.
Plenty of freight forwarders can move your product in and out across the border. It's not a big deal anymore.
Yeah. Before we get too much more into the details, let me ask you again about the family business. Were there siblings that you worked with?
Sure. So I'm one of 18 first cousins.
Oh,
so
wow.
in the okay. third, and that's on my dad's side. So in at our peak, we had four dads and six sons in the boardroom and about four other cousins working outside the boardroom. We had about 3,500 people. When we sold the business, we were about $550 million revenue. So it was, it's not a little mom-pa business by any stretch.
Yeah, yeah. Now, obviously, that makes Thanksgiving and Christmas interesting times. And,
oh, yeah.
You know, without divulging too much, how did you say the, how would you say the overall dynamic worked out?
So, you know, the one word answer is well. What I didn't understand until 7 years after I left the business is that in one sense, we were an anomaly. For the most part, everyone got along. Every family business makes a choice. Is it business first or family first? There's no right answer. But it's got to be one. And we chose family first. And you know, knowingly, the business was sub-optimized in some areas to keep family relations good. But that was our priority, and it was the right decision for us. There were a couple of guys who didn't get along, but it didn't matter whether they were family or not. They were never going to get along. But everyone played nice in the sandbox.
Oftentimes the challenge, and I want to talk about this because it's so common in the entrepreneurial world, especially in the startup phase, you get an idea to start a business and you often recruit family or close friends because
sure.
you like them, you trust them, you think you can count on them, and you get the business up and out of the ground. And you know, on one hand, that's not a bad idea, but unless you have some very specific conscious thought and decision-making, like sounds like you guys did, you're going to have those struggles.
Well, there's a tremendous body of work about this, and you are spot on. The challenges vary with the stage and size of the business. It, of course, starts with open communication and not being afraid to talk about tough subjects. If you can deal with that, you can get through most of it. If you are unwilling to talk about tough issues, it tends not to be good. But, you know, if it's one or two people, it's one thing. If it's really the family, then, you know, I often like to talk to folks about what's called a family constitution, which is basically, these are the rules of the business. If you want to come into the business, here's what you got to do first. You know, is employment based on merit? Is it based on something else? What about compensation? That's when you're really multi-generational. You know, if it's just within one generation, it's really about communication and openness on who's going to do what and dealing with bad news and the question of how do we deal with accountability?
Yeah.
Because the business still needs to get run. And you just need to... You just need to all agree on what those rules are.
Yeah. I'm thinking, I've got a good friend here locally. We do a lot of work together, and that's one of his specialties is helping family-owned businesses. And
sure.
As a byproduct of some of our discussions, I wrote an article once that I said, is your family-owned business too much family? And, you know, that's a question that definitely needs to get asked and answered. I, for one, in my last iteration as an entrepreneur, mine was a family business by many respects. I had a lot. My wife and I were working side by side, and we had some of our children join us for seasons. One
sure.
of them joined us permanently. Others were kind of in and out as the need required, but yeah, the one that joined us permanently, he was our youngest. And I told him when he got there, I said, look, when you walk through that door, it's not mom and dad. It's boss and co-boss.
Right.
And you are an employee and you're going to get treated like everybody else. You get no special privileges. If you're out of line, you're going to pay the consequences. And I think he heard me, but I'm not sure he believed me. And then about 6 weeks in, he started acting out and doing some things. And I locked him up. I said, "You're on probation. You know, you can't do that."
And it's better for the kids, regardless of whether they stay with the business or go out in the world. Reality is always there, no matter how much you try to avoid it. And they'll be better served being on the straight and narrow.
Yeah.
If you don't hold your kids accountable, you're not doing them any favors.
Yeah. Well, I'm proud to say that this is almost 20 years later. He is the one child, I've got five, that followed in the footsteps, and he's now vice president of a regional bank. And we were in a banking related business, and he learned the nuts and bolts and took it and worked his way up. And he's head of a department now at his bank and doing quite well. So I'm real proud of him. I'm proud of all my kids, but for him, for that particular angle on it, you know. But let's shift gears and talk about your book. For those of you that are going to watch us on video, there is an image of the book in the background on Bruce's screen. It's called The Ownership Journey. Tell us about the inspiration for that book, Bruce.
Sure. So 20 years ago, I started consulting. My friend said, "Well, if you're a consultant, you have to write a book." And I said, "Well, it seems like a lot of work, and I don't have anything to say, so I'm just going to work it out anyway." And after about 15 or so years as consulting, I realized I had things I wanted to say. So I started writing columns. I write a column on Forbes. I write a column on a site called Financial Poise for the things that were on my mind. And after doing that for a few years, I realized there's something bigger here. And that was the genesis of the book. And the book really goes through the life cycle of ownership, because as an owner, your needs change over time. And, you know, my consulting practice is helping people solve the problems that keep them awake at night. So the path starts with, what's your ownership strategy? Not your business strategy, but you as a human being, what do you want to do with your life? And how does this business help you achieve that? You can make more money, but you can't make more time.
Right.
This tends to be more relevant when people are, they're over 50, they've had some success, they kind of know their business. They're starting to think more than just putting food on the table. Clearly, if your business is struggling or you're earlier in the life cycle, you're not there yet. But you know, the benefit of success is you get harder problems to solve. And so I help people figure out, you know, what do you want to do? You know, what gives you pleasure? What do you want to leave behind? And then what does the business have to do to allow you to get there? Therefore, what's the business strategy? And therefore, what capital and talent do you need to drive the business strategy? All that we link together. Sometimes there's some M&A involved to drive the growth strategy. There's always a governance perspective. Do I need a board? Do I not need a board? How do I use the board to make sure we kind of keep things between the guardrails? There's a chapter on managing conflict, because that always happens, whether it's family disagreements or partners or whatever. Management succession is hugely important. If you don't have someone to run the business, you have a problem. Most business owners choose to employ themselves as CEO, but that's actually a choice. You know, you get to a point, you say, you know what, I want to spend more time fishing, or I hire someone else to run the business for me. It's the privilege of success. And then as you get to the latter stages, you know, we all either die or retire at some point. So you can pick one, not the other, as they say. So if you're starting to think about, hey, maybe I want to sell the business, or I want to transition to my kids, how do we plan that last stage of the game? And then the last chapter is what I call life after the deal. A lot of people spend 30 or 40 years working. They store up a nest egg and say, one day I'm going to just live at the beach and go fishing and life will be grand. It doesn't really work that way at all. And certainly with our generation and the younger generation, there's no more traditional retirement. You do other things with your life. You may have second or third careers. You may devote yourself to nonprofit, or if you're a great artist, you do other things. So figuring out that transition is actually fairly tough. You know, the evidence is that people who work their whole life, retire, then move to Florida, if they don't have a plan of what to do, they tend to be miserable, and 6 months later, they're dead. So you need to have a purpose when you move to the next stage of life. And that's a job in and of itself. So I try to string together from when you decide to own your own business until when you're out of it and moving on to the next stage, and give practical advice along the way to, you know, increase your chance of both success and happiness.
Yeah. Do you, with all your experience, the company that you were a big part of and others since, and maybe through clients as well, do you have your own estimate of the notion of business life cycle? Do you talk to people about that?
Sure. So there's you know, well-established academic and practical businesses have life cycles. So if I remember the old chart from business school, you know, there's a startup phase, a growth phase, a mature phase, and then decline. And businesses move along that spectrum, both forward and backwards, frankly, just kind of depending upon what their market conditions are, the talent of their leadership, and their other circumstances. But you really need to know where you are. You know, the startup and growth phase are the really exciting part because there's so much change going on. You can make things happen. The mature part is, you know, like the cash cow, you know, just kind of trudging along, which it could be fine. But there's a real problem with that is that if you aren't staying competitive, you move into the decline phase. Businesses die when they're no longer competitive, or they don't have talent, or they don't have capital. And so as an owner, separating ownership from management, you got to keep that vibrancy going. Otherwise, the business will die. I mean, look at General Electric. For 110 years, they were the most dominant industrial company on the planet. They don't exist anymore. I mean, there's a, you know, think of all the old automobile companies, the steel companies, you know, phone companies that they're just not around because they lost relevance or didn't have the right management team. Or for the most part, the big issue, the market moves and they're so invested in their current product line, they can't shift to the new product. You know, Apple made a big deal of cannibalizing their own products in the early days. So they would cannibalize their own products so the competition wouldn't, because they were always moving ahead. As an owner, you kind of have to decide what's your approach.
Yeah.
What can you afford and how much risk are you willing to tolerate?
I think one of the famous ones that I certainly always think about because of my place in life here is, you know, Kodak was famous for...
Sure.
They
Polaroid.
Absolutely dominated the photography market for decades. And then poof, you know.
Right.
Although I heard recently somebody said part of Kodak is back, and I'm not clear. I need to research that.
I had heard that it's not the camera side. They had other technologies and patents kind of outside of the consumer space, I think, are coming back. Xerox also, you know, owned the copier business. That disappeared. Fax machines disappeared. Xerox had great technologies. They've got other lines of business that are not as visible in the public eye.
Yeah.
But a shadow of their former selves.
Oh, sure. For sure. Well, I'll tell you what, Bruce, it's hard to believe we're already up on kind of a break point in the show here. I want to pause, take a short commercial break. And when we come back, we're going to dive into a couple more of these challenges on the different phases that businesses go through. So hang with us, folks. We'll be right back.
Business is all about solving complex problems as fast as you can create them. Become the best problem solver by leading others to greatness, too. And the first step is going to DougThorpe.com. Doug Thorpe is known globally for coaching entrepreneurs and business leaders, improving their performance and the work output of everyone surrounding them. You can find health, wealth, and happiness by learning to lead others to health, wealth, and happiness. Go to DougThorpe.com now and order Doug's books or hire him to coach your managers. That's Doug, T-H-O-R-P-E.com.
Well, all right, everyone, we're back. This is Leadership Powered by Common Sense. I'm Doug Thorpe, and my guest today is Bruce Werner. We're talking about the ownership journey, and I personally just get excited about that word journey. I think we're all on some kind of a journey. Our life here on this planet as we spin around the sun is one chapter after another of experience and opportunity that comes our way. And a big part of that is trying to make the best of it, right? And Bruce, you've got a thought about what a prospective or current business owner ought to be doing to set that up correctly. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. So when I have a new relationship, I always start talking to them as a human being, as a person, not as a business owner, not as a leader of industry, but just as a person to get to know them. And the question is, well, what do you want to do with your life? You can start another business. You can make more money. You know, you can buy another Ferrari, all that stuff. That's not what people think about at the end of the day.
Yeah.
They think about, what did I achieve with my life? Why is the world a better place because of me? Am I happy? You know, and some people are more selfish. It's more narrowly focused there. You know, serving others isn't that priority. I'm not judging. I'm just like, what's really important to you? Because if we can focus on that, we can make everything line up to go make that happen. That's where the magic is. And so, you know, that really ties back to, if you want to do X, Y, or Z, what do you need to get there? Well, for most people, is I need to create some wealth to go give back to my community, or make sure my family is financially secure, or because it just makes me feel good. That's fine. But we can build out a financial plan, simply, so that you can achieve your life goals. And to me, that just seems like a better way to spend your time here. I mean, to make money just to make money, at a certain point, it's nice, but it's not fulfilling.
Right.
So it's about what fulfills you. That's where I like to start the conversation. So then everything kind of rolls out from there.
Yeah. I see that happening so often when I get a chance to work with more senior executives, and often this is true in the bigger businesses that I might work with. They spend, you know, 15, 20, 25 years on a career path, and then it is almost a certainty. I'm going to leave a small percentage of variance open here, but it's almost a certainty that there's a day that comes when that person wakes up and says, is all this worth it? You know, what have I really done?
What the hell am I doing?
What the hell am I doing? Do I want to keep doing this? And does it make a difference?
Right.
And if I ever get into that discussion with a client, inevitably what we'll talk about is, all right, great question. Let's talk about your legacy. What do you want to leave behind? What mark do you want to make? And you are spot on. The answer I get when I ask that question is never about wealth and money.
It's about relationships.
Never, ever. It's about the relationships. And for the guys that have, you know, done their professional careers, they are committed to wondering, can I leave a mark on this company?
Right.
And they might not be the CEO, but they are a senior officer, department head of some sort. And, you know, what I then start working with them on is the idea that the only way you're going to do that is to start by handpicking some subordinate leaders that work for you or report to you, and start mentoring, coaching, and developing them in things that you haven't even touched on yet.
Right.
And, you know, that usually gets them really energized and really motivated. And then all of a sudden, they've got a whole new lease on life and a whole new inspiration for what they want to do.
Yeah. So what I'd say is, you know, ownership strategy is what we touched on earlier, really has four components. The first is, how do you want to spend your time? The second is, what does financial security mean to you? The third is, what do you want your business legacy to be? When you're not there, what do people know? And the fourth is, who do you want to take care of when you're gone? Because the good owners know that they didn't do it on their own. They had a team. Typically, people have been with them their whole careers. They're effectively family. But they're just employees. So when they sell the company and the owner takes the big check and goes away, they just go to work the next day. So I've seen a lot of guys say, you know what, I'm just going to take something out of my pocket and take care of these guys, because without them, I would not have been successful. So those four components are how I define an ownership strategy. Four questions, everyone answers them their own way.
I like that. I think that's really good. And I want to go back to something you said in the first half. We were talking about four stages of a company, and you were saying that it's inevitable in that fourth stage, if the company is not able to adapt, change, and grow
Stay competitive.
with the market, remain competitive. They're going to go on a decline. And one thing I'm reminded of when you said that, there's another show I did recently with a guy named Steve Anderson, and he did a bunch of research and wrote a phenomenal book called The Bezos Letters. It's a study of Jeff Bezos and
I think I've heard of that.
his management thesis and vision for what he wanted Amazon to be, and going all the way back to 1997 when he wrote his first letter to shareholders. He started laying out these values and these principles. And one of the ones that stands out, and there's 14 of them, by the way, it's a long list, but it's really powerful. One of them that stands out is the philosophy that every day is day one. And it speaks to that mindset about trying to look ahead with great anticipation and grow the business and always keep that out in front of you. And allegedly, there was a day he was having a town hall with a bunch of employees, and he opened the mic for questions. And somebody said, "What does day two look like?" And he thought a minute and he said, "Well, day two, we begin our decline." And he said, "If we ever get to day two, we're going to be on the slide to
On the
oblivion."
other side. Yep.
And he said, "That's the point in always pressing day one. We don't ever want to get there. We want to be innovative. We want to be creative. We want to be responsive to market changes." And golly, you start drawing a blueprint of everything that has spun out of the core business that Amazon. I'll say it this way: it's hard to define what Amazon's core business is right now because they've got so many.
Delivery of services.
At the top of the mountain, yes, I would agree with you. But the variety and the bandwidth across all of that is absolutely mind-boggling.
Day two starts when they run out of new things to sell.
Could be. But then at that point, they'll rely on their whole AWS network, and that's making more money for
Sure.
them anyway. So,
Sure.
crazy stuff. Well, when you talk to these owners about their ownership strategy, and I really like that idea, that theme. How hard is it for people to really answer that question?
The truth is, most people, a lot of people are stumped because they've never stopped to think about it. Most owners of private companies are so busy making the donuts, as they say, they don't have time to step back. So what I like to say is, let's separate working in the business versus working on the business. Most owners spend 95% of the time working in the business, getting orders, paying bills, staffing, all that stuff. They spend 5% working on the business. What do I want this business to be and why? How much risk will I take? How will I finance it? Do I really want to run it or have someone else run it for me? The truth is, most of the value comes from answering the questions of working on the business, where you spend 5% of the time. The 95% of the time is the execution. You got to get that right, but if you don't get that 5% right, it doesn't matter. I've had a lot of people just kind of stop in their tracks. Doesn't matter how successful they are. It's like, oh, some of them don't want to slow down to think about it. It's like, what are you going to say on your deathbed? That's the question I'm asking. When you're at your end of days and you look back, what's important? And then why wait until then? Why don't we work on that now when you can enjoy the upside? There certainly are folks who are thoughtful and mindful enough to have structure and thoughts, or their worldview may just be, frankly, simple enough that it's just like right in front of them, which is great. not true for most folks. If they've got the skills and talents to build a meaningful business, there's a lot of complexity to unwrap.
Yeah. What about the guy that has been in business for a while and he's got some success, which means he does have some money in the bank, and now maybe they're even getting a little bit
complacent?
Not complacent. No, they're getting a little bit bored with what they're doing, so they start.
Sure.
They start getting attracted by bright, shiny objects to branch out here or create this subsidiary or maybe go buy
Absolutely.
A new business. What do you say to those guys?
So the issue of boredom is different from the issue of business strategy. If you've been running your business for a while, you're successful, but you're kind of bored, then let's talk about how do we get some enrichment in your life without making bad business decisions. You know, if you have no hobbies, you know, let's go take some golf lessons or learn to paint or, you know, go work at the church or do something, but don't screw up your business because you're bored. That's the first point of zone. The second is, what's your business strategy? If you have it dialed in and everything's great, which is why you're bored, that probably also means you're not growing. You know, each year is a cut and paste of the last year. Well, that's the beginning of day two, as Bezos would say. You typically only see a decline in the rear of your mirror. But if things are just ho-hum and you're working 10 hours a week and everything's fine and the checks keep coming in, I'd actually be nervous because the markets don't tolerate that. Now, if you're fortunate that you're in a market where you could do that for 20 to 30 years, great. I would not accept that without testing it a little bit. But I wouldn't screw up your business because you're bored. Well, go start another business.
One thought that comes to my mind, you know, there's a popular phrase that among some people, they say, I want these opportunities that create mailbox money. You know, I want checks routinely flowing in. Okay, that's great. And if you can truly create
go buy real estate.
What's that?
Go buy real estate.
Yeah.
That's what you want. Operating companies don't work that way.
Well, that's where I was going. I think the notion of that, there's a lot more work to it than that. And I think that the true bona fide definition of that is pretty narrow. And it's not to say there aren't some of those kind of opportunities. But if my point is, if you're an entrepreneur and that's all you created, you probably are going to get bored with it after a while. Our minds need to get challenged and stimulated. And so I like your point. Question number one might be, you know, go get a hobby. Do you have a hobby? Do you have an outside interest? And I love that wisdom, you know, don't screw up your current business by dabbling in another one. But narrow the question back down. What about the guy that is looking in the domain of his business and seeing these sort of tangential opportunities to invest and create subsidiaries and do other things that are branches of the core business?
Well, I certainly would not want to be misunderstood as don't go do it. But I think you need to have the same weather eye on it. Does this create value for my current business, and do my current customers care about it, or is it really something new and different that I'm willing to take some risk on? And if so, how do I separate that risk from my core business? Because it might make sense to go do that, but it's a new business. You got to treat it like a new business, but don't screw up your current business. Just don't, you know, be thoughtful about it, and you know why you're doing it. If it's really going to help your core business grow, great. But if it's really just, it sounds interesting, it's new and different, that's okay, but don't confuse it.
Yeah. And the thing that comes to my mind when I think about entrepreneurs, and I've worked with a couple of them that, you know, the thing that makes them successful is their idea people. They've got ideas and they're out there making those come to life. But the challenge in launching a new idea inside the team you might have already built is that your team may not be ready for that. Your team may not be capable.
Maybe the wrong team.
It could be the wrong team, but that's usually the go-to solution. It's like, well, I've got a really good, you know, operations manager, so I'm just going to pile another log on his stack to make him go do these things. And
that's, you know, that may be okay to test an idea, but if you really want to build a new business, if it's separate from your current business, you got to treat it as a new venture. You know, if you're selling to the same customers, to the same channels, to the same sales force, you know, that's more like a product line extension.
Yeah,
no problem there. We get it. But what you're asking is something that doesn't sell to the same customers, doesn't sell to the same sales force, different. I think you got to be really careful. Doesn't mean don't go do it, but just be careful that you're treating it with the same discernment and thought as you do your core business.
I like that. And I'm going to shift gears again, and I'm kind of trying to pack a lot into our time here. But in the first half of the show, you alluded to the idea of having a board or an advisory board. Mm-hmm. Talk to me about how you encourage entrepreneurs that don't yet have any of that going on. What are the decision points to start exploring the need for that?
Yeah, so you know, when you think about a board, there's different types of boards. And it is anything but one size fits all. It's like a custom fit suit. It's just for you. So you have to start with, what do I want this board to do for me and why? Boards are effective at addressing issues that are a few years forward. Don't put together a board to help get through this month or this quarter or this year. It's not what they're good at. You think about, what do I think are my challenges a couple of years out? And how do I get experience to help guide me through that, that's not working in the business? That's the right place to start. You know, good boards are designed, so typically you have three outsiders. You have to think about, well, what are the skills and experiences I want? You know, so it's typically, I need a really good marketing person, because we don't have that inside. I want someone who's a great connector to open doors for our salespeople. Maybe I need someone who's a supply chain expert or an IT expert, because of what I need, given who my management team is. You certainly don't want to, the rule of thumb is, you don't put someone on a board if you could rent them as a consultant. And that's more true with IT, because technology changes so quickly. You know, when you put a person on your board, the technology is going to change typically faster than they can keep up. So there's a whole art to designing and staffing a board. And boards, you know, they typically start out as a couple of golf buddies that you have lunch with, and then they get more serious. So it's what I call, you know, consulting boards, junior advisory boards, full advisory boards, and fiduciary boards. And that fits with the evolution of a business. There's a lot of evidence, and I see it, that when entrepreneurs get to 20 or 30 million revenue, and the challenges they have are beyond their current team, that's when they really start asking, hey, you know, should I get a board? There's a little more here than I can handle. Companies, you know, smaller certainly have them, absolutely. But when that's kind of when people hit the wall and they need outside talent, and it scales up from there.
Yeah, yeah. Good word, good word. Well, we're kind of close on our time here, Bruce, and I really appreciate all your insights here.
Thank you.
I want to close. I want to come back to, I think it was the thought we started this second half with, having owners and entrepreneurs and anyone who's thinking about becoming an entrepreneur really ask that deep personal question, you know, why am I really doing this? What's my, you call it, I think, the ownership plan?
Not ownership strategy. Plan?
Strategy, okay.
You as an owner, what's your strategy as an owner? Separate from your business strategy.
And run through those quick questions again that you wrap into.
So the four questions are, how do I want to spend my time? Because we don't make any more of it. The second is, what does financial security mean to me? The third is, what do I want my business legacy to be? And the last is, what about the people who made you successful? Those are the questions that, you know, when people are long out of the chair and they think about, that's what gnaws at them over time. But if they deal with them in the present and think about what they're going to be satisfied with, then, you know, when they're, you know, retired or gone or, you know, later in life, they can feel good about it.
Yeah.
No reason to spend the last 20 years of your life saying, you know, I wish I would have taken better care of Fred. He worked so hard and, you know, I should have just, you know, taken care of him. Why not just deal with that now?
Right, right. I love that framework. I think that's so critically important. And the only add that I'll make to that is for those of you out there that already have your business up and running, I think it's the Chinese proverb that says, when's the best time to plant a tree? It was 20 years ago, but if you didn't do that, do it today.
Yep.
I think having a visit, going out, sitting under a tree and take your favorite adult beverage with you and think about that ownership strategy. Create one for the first time if you've never done it before. And if you have one, obviously those are things that need to get revisited and adjusted over time as things change and opportunities arise. But great wisdom, great thoughts. And so thank you so much, Bruce, for sharing that with
us. Thank you for having me.
You bet. Hey, if people want to get a hold of you, what's the best way to do that?
So my website is www.brucewarner.com. That's Warner with two E's. My business website is konaadvisors.com, K-O-N-A, advisors. Certainly, you can reach me by email, bruce@konaadvisors.com.
Great. And we will have all of that link information in the show notes, folks. So if you didn't catch it on the fly, just check out our footnotes on the episode. This is the place I always remind everybody that if you're listening to us through your favorite streaming service, we do have a video version of this episode over on YouTube, channel by the same name, Leadership Powered by Common Sense. I'm your host, Doug Thorpe, and we are dropping shows 3 days a week. So we've got a lot of content coming at you. So one last time, Bruce, thanks again for being on the show.
Thank you.
And for that, we'll say goodbye, folks. Thank you. Thank you for listening in, if I can get that out. And we hope to see you again real soon. Take care. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Leadership Powered by Common Sense, hosted by Doug Thorpe. If you would like to know more about the coaching and advisory services he provides, visit DougThorpe.com.